On this week's podcast, we're joined by Doug Powell, who gives us an insider's view of the remarkable transformation at IBM that's put design best practice at the heart of the organisation. This week's podcast is sponsored by Full Story and Balsamic. Hello and welcome to the BOAG World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name's Paul BOAG. I've got a bottle of Bournemouth in front of me, so I'm now handing across to Marcus Lillington.
Well, I'll just run with this bit, Paul, that's no problem. Although I'm a bit hungover, if I'm honest. I had too much to drink last night on a Sunday on a school night.
See, now, you're so irresponsible, Marcus. It's disgraceful.
I haven't got any beer or cider on my desk at the moment, though.
But I need it. It's medicinal. because my stress levels are just through the roof. I'm 2 weeks off of being homeless, and I'm just hoping that my new house is done by then.
Yeah, what happens if you're not? Working from the garden?
We're moving in, even if it's a building tip. Actually, they're painting it today, so that's a start, right? It's got to be near the end if they're painting it.
That's like one of the last things, isn't it? Has to be.
I know. So we got painting, floor, and then that's pretty much, skirting board and stuff like that. So we're nearly there. And I have the nicest office in the world. You're going to be so envious of my office. It's got bifold doors. It's got an open fire in it. And it's got the nicest office desk in the world ever.
Where's it from then? What's this desk? Tell me all about it. Because I was looking at my ancient IKEA desk that I bought when we started Headscape.
Right.
You know, it's got things like C4M carved in it and stuff like that. It hasn't really. But
This desk is what I call the height of pretentious, impractical luxury.
Does it go up and down?
No, that would be practical and useful.
Oh, yeah.
No. This desk, I bought it from Etsy.
Right.
And it's made out of reclaimed scaffolding boards and scaffolding poles.
Okay. You're not selling it.
It looks stunning, but probably weighs 3/4 of a ton. And will be totally impractical in every sense. So that's why it's got no cable management on it. It's just a friggin' massive, gorgeous wooden desk.
That's nice. So there we go.
It does look nice.
I was seriously thinking the other day about, you know what, maybe I should actually change my office after 16 years of it being exactly the same. There's probably still dust under the desk from 2002.
But you've got to keep your nice guitars in the background, otherwise people won't have anything to talk to you about when they call you.
This is true. It works every time. New client, we do a go-to meeting call or something like that, and they can't help themselves. Oh, look at your guitars. Every time.
I know, it just looks so cool.
Yeah, and actually, 25 years ago, I was in a pop band, don't you know? And that's it. And then they don't care about whatever I'm talking to them about work-wise. Works every time.
It's great. It covers up a multitude of sins. Hey, so Marcus, what's your thought for the day, sir? Do we have one?
Yes, we do.
Ooh, you're organised.
I am being organised. I'm giving myself a, because we record this on Mondays. I'm saying every Friday morning I've got to listen to the interview and I've got to come up with a thought for the day. And the thoughts for the day are all kind of usually related to something that's happened. And this one's about dealing with rejection.
Oh, Marcus, have you been rejected?
I haven't, no, but Chris has. Oh. And Chris isn't very good at dealing with it, which made me think about, and I'm not particularly good, but I can kind of go, well, you know, that's his life. And I thought, well, I'll just put some thoughts down about that. Obviously, I'm talking about from a, if you're pitching for work and you're rejected point of view, not if you're sort of trying to find love and you're rejected, because I wouldn't know anything about that. I've been married for 100 years.
And you were never rejected as well.
Obviously.
Girls just walk into the same room as you and immediately swoon. So,
all the time, you know. Yeah. It's just annoying. I can't speak to any of them.
No, it must be very difficult for you. I, on the other hand, could talk with great authority about being rejected in love. So there we go.
But maybe we'll save that one for another day, Paul.
I think I'll save that for my therapist.
Yes. Anyway, right, I've got notes in here, but they're too small for my rubbish old eyes, so I'm just going to make it bigger. There we go. Oh, that's better. Oh, fantastic. Right, so yes, something that I'm kind of reasonably good at, but Chris isn't. And this particular proposal that you put out, neither of us thought stood any chance of winning. It was one of those ones, not enough budget, you know, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But he still was like, about it. So, and obviously this is because we put a lot of effort into pitches and proposals, and obviously not winning those can be quite hard to take. Sometimes we don't even get a no thanks. We're just completely ignored. I've talked about that in the past, and that's
that drives me nuts. That's just rude.
Yeah, I mentioned that on today's chat on the BOAG World Slack channel about things that annoy you or your pet hates. That's more than a pet hate. People that don't get back to you anyway. But I think the key to dealing with rejection is to ask yourself why you might not have been selected in the first place. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a number of reasons. The first one, which always comes to my mind, is that you're just making up...
Excuse me. Can I list a load of reasons why Chris might have been rejected?
This is going to be nasty.
He's Scottish.
Number one, racism. Yep.
Yeah. He's far too fit. I mean, he's old. Ageism.
Three, yeah.
He's even older than you. I mean, that's really old.
He's quite a lot older than me.
And also, he's very pernickety. I mean, why would you... someone like that...
Yeah.
I mean, you can have too much attention to detail, in my opinion.
Oh, no, I was going to be rude to you there, Paul. But no, you're right.
Anyway, carry on. I'm sure you were going to make a much better point than that.
The reason why you wouldn't be selected is because you're just making up the numbers, which is a really kind of stinky fact of life. Virtually all pieces of work have to go out to some form of tender, whether or not the client has already decided who they want to work with, which is just shit, frankly. But we've been on the receiving end of this, but we've also been the selected agency and known that others are wasting their time, which always makes me feel really awkward. But you're like, what can you do about it? I know that you kind of refuse to do pitches, Paul, don't you? But
generally, yeah.
But we can't, you know, and I don't think many people can. So you've just got to accept that sometimes you will be making up numbers. I'm better at recognising this now, but not always. I'm going to a pitch on Wednesday, and it's one of those I'm not sure about. So I'll report back next week on that one. But you've got to remember, in that particular situation, you never stood a chance. So, hey-ho. Number two, you lost on price. Though we all try very hard to get to the bottom of what a budget is, someone may simply be cheaper than you. And if you're being specifically marked, you know, like some kind of public sector tenders, they'll have a table of a matrix of marking and all this kind of thing. And they'll have a formula for working out your score on price. And if somebody comes in halfway, then everyone else is stuffed.
Yep.
So, so in that case, you didn't stand a chance. If it keeps happening, then maybe you need to review your pricing. But once in a while, it's just life. The third one... is that you maybe suggested an alternative solution that you think and probably is better, but it simply wasn't what they thought they wanted, what the client wanted. The client said they wanted X, Y, and Z. You said, well, you don't really want, you might want X and Y, but you don't want Z, and this is why. And then you didn't offer Z, and they said, well, you didn't offer Z. That's why we didn't give it to you. And that's just the kind of punt you've got to take at the start of responding to a proposal. Sometimes it can win you work because you can make suggestions that make you seem, you know, like you really know what you're talking about, but sometimes it doesn't. I'm trying to recognise when to do this and when not. This is another thought, because I've got written down a load of possible thoughts for the days, and this was another one, and I honestly don't know the answer, but I might think some more on it about if you can recognise when to do that and when not. Anyway, the penultimate one is you didn't have the skills or the offering that other people did. Recruiting for testing is something that came up about 6 months ago, which, you know, it's not something that we particularly want to get into. Somebody else offered it. They got it. Hey, such is life. And that actually, this is one that you'll normally get the truth from the client on. They'll just say, this other agency offered this and you didn't. So,
yeah.
And you might not want to start offering that, but at least you might deal with it in your next proposal head on, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the final one is just quite simply, you weren't as good as the opposition. And let's face it, there's always someone better than you, isn't there? So
yeah,
it might just simply be that. So always ask why you weren't selected, but be prepared to be either none the wiser or have to read very much between the lines, because quite often people won't be able to say why, particularly if you were just making up the numbers. Sorry, Bill.
I was just going to say there is another one as well, which is sometimes the, you know, the people you go against to overpromise. You know, either they barefaced lie, mm-hmm. which is unusual, or alternatively they're desperate for work and so will offer to do a lot more in order to secure the work. So, you know, there's mm-hmm. that as well.
I've kind of had that one. I used to be, it's kind of like our policy and certainly my policy to be kind of disarmingly honest. And I think that can win you work. But with regard to timescales, I think we've done ourselves down in the past, and we're a lot more realistic now, because many briefs or tenders will say this must be delivered by next Tuesday or no chance kind of thing, and obviously that never ever happens. So to have a kind of like, I tend to take the attitude of we possibly could work to this if everything kind of falls, if all the planets fall into line, but chances are it won't, and let's work together on reaching a new set of timescales if that happens. But we could do it for you is kind of what my current way of thinking on timescales. Maybe not with price. But anyway, I think if you've been rejected and you're feeling bad about it, maybe just run through those things I've just mentioned, and you mentioned, Paul, and you might feel a bit better about it. That's my thought.
The truth is, it's part of sales. You're just not going to win everything. Sometimes you're not the right fit. I often think as well that if you don't win something, often that can be a blessing. You know, it can be that you're not the right fit. You've not got the right attitude for them. Mm-hmm. And if those things are the case, then you're well away from it, because it would turn into a nightmare project.
Yeah,
I know. You know, when you haven't got enough work coming in, those feelings of rejection intensify, but it's life, unfortunately. It's just part of the game.
Exactly.
And this, of course, all of that applies. Well, it doesn't, the same points, but the same principle applies with jobs as well. If you're going for a job, I'm working with a mentor at the moment who's trying to find a job, and he's finding it quite a frustrating process. And, you know, not everybody fits in with every job, and there's loads of reasons why you might not get a job that's not a reflection on your abilities. Mm. You know, there's so many things that can go wrong. You know, it's just part of the game, isn't it, really?
Exactly.
Okay, well, thank you very much. That was a very nice thought for the day, although that might be the cider speaking. All right, let's talk about our first sponsor, which is Balsamic. The easy way to use wireframe to produce wireframes with a really low barrier to entry. I use it all the time. Most people are aware of the desktop app, but they also have a cloud-based app now as well. It's absolutely brilliant for collaboration. I often use it with working with clients, actually in meetings. So I'll use it to explain something to a stakeholder or to demonstrate an idea.
We do too.
You do too?
Yep.
Yes, it's brilliant.
Live wireframing.
Do you ever give the client control and say, well, just show me what you mean, drag it around? I do that sometimes.
God, no,
as well.
Paul.
Oh, no, is that a mistake? Have I gone too far?
No, it's just, if we're doing a kind of IA-related workshop, then the days of scribbling on paper are long gone, because it's so much quicker to do it using Balsamic.
Mm. And I work as well with, I'm about to start soon a project with a company in America. So I can't sit in a room and do that kind of stuff because, you know, apparently it's too expensive to fly me out there to stay in a luxury villa for 2 weeks while I work with them.
A villa?
I don't know. Obviously,
by the
yes.
sea, obviously.
Obviously. I think that's part of the problem, that they're right in middle America. So, you know, they have to pay for the private jet from the coast. Apparently, some people are so tight, it's unbelievable. Yeah. So as a result, I'm going to use balsamic as a way of kind of, you know, managing a lot of that, those discussions, etc. And it's great as well. The reason I like letting the client free on balsamic as well is because it gives them a sense of ownership and engagement. And that means they're more likely to, you know, like what the design turns out with and all of those kinds of things. So you can get a 30-day free trial. Give it a go for yourself. If you like it and you decide to sign up, when you enter all your billing information, if you pop in the code BOAGWORLD alongside your billing information, then you'll get an additional 3 months free. So that's a total of 4 months to play with it without paying a penny, which I think is more than reasonable, really. So you can do that by going to balsamic.cloud, because there are funky, cool domain names now, like .cloud. I've got, what's it? BOAG World Academy now. BOAGworld.academy. There you go.
What's that? Oh, no, I don't want to know.
You don't want to know.
You're going to set up a school, Paul?
No, it's this course thing that I'm doing, this new course. Which, by the way, I'm doing in collaboration with the guys at Balsamic, because they're that awesome. So, and actually, here's a top tip. I can't believe I'm going to give you this tip. I'm going to be selling this course that I'm doing with Balsamic, and it's not cheap, because frankly I'm worth it, but if you sign up, it's worse when you don't laugh, Marcus, when I say things like that and you just go quiet.
I'm just shocked.
You're shocked, the audacity of him claiming. So anyway, but if you sign up for Balsamic, I'm pretty sure they're going to be giving it away free to their users. So it'll work out considerably cheaper to get Balsamic than it would be to buy it from me. But I didn't say that.
You're showing your business nous here, Chris, Paul, whatever your name
Paul.
Is. I've got my cider too.
Well, to be honest, I'm not, because that's a really dumbass thing. It's great for Balsamic. It's shit for me. So, but there you go.
Yeah, I was being sarcastic.
Oh, I see. That went above my head because of the cider.
Yes.
So let's, as I seem to be slowly degenerating at this point, let's go back to a previous me who recently interviewed Doug Powell from IBM when I was sober. And actually, it's a really great interview where Doug talks us through really the remarkable user experience revolution that's been going on at IBM, where they are just absolutely transforming the way that they operate at a global level. The scale of it is just terrifyingly large. So it's an absolutely fascinating interview, and I highly recommend it. So hello, Doug, and thank you for joining us on the show. It's really great to have you here. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So I think probably a good place to start, if that's all right, if you tell us a little bit about your role at IBM and what's going on there and that kind of thing.
Well, I joined IBM about 5 years ago as the renewed program of design, user experience design and design thinking was being launched in the early part of 2013. My role at the time was to lead our education, our internal educational programming around design and design thinking. That was targeting both designers that we were bringing into the company, as well as non-designers around IBM who needed to understand the design and design thinking to a certain level in order to really adopt this new way of working that we were promoting within the company. And so early on, my role was very focused on design education. My role has changed over the course of the 5 years, and really the common thread for me has been how do we scale design and design thinking across a company of now 360,000 people in 170 countries, you know, around the world, with thousands of different offerings, products and services out in the marketplace and thousands of clients that we're servicing. So, really, scale has been the common thread for me throughout all of the roles that I've played here.
I mean, it strikes me as an incredible challenge. I mean, I started, believe it or not, I started my career off at IBM as an intern, and then back in about 93, 94. So I spent a year as a student working at IBM and then went back and worked there for another 3 years. So I've got very much a sense of the scale of the organization. And of course, when I was there, it was anything but a design focused organization. It was a huge monolithic creature, very much stuck in the past. I mean, so I guess my first question is, how did that shift begin to, how did it start? How did this shift towards more design and user-centric begin at IBM?
Right. Well, you look at a couple of factors. One, that in late 2011, but really sort of taking force in 2012, was our current CEO, Ginni Rometty, taking her role. And Ginni has a very visceral belief in what she would call the customer experience, and she talks a lot about how customer experience is really going to be the driver of the future of the company. You translate that a little bit. Turn her words a little bit into our context, and really what she's talking about is the user experience, the human experience that people have with IBM, with our products and services, our digital products and services, our spaces, our brand, our people. All of those experiences are really important. Likewise, you look at what was happening in the broader sort of tech market and even the broader culture in 2011, 2012, as Ginni was sort of getting into her new role. And there we were in the midst of a user experience revolution at that time across all of the devices that we use, across all of the ways that we interacted with content and information and media, and really everything was undergoing a major change there. As you said, companies like IBM, big global companies that had been around for decades, if not more than a century, as IBM has, they're very hard to change, much harder than it is to change a smaller, startup, for instance. And, but Ginni really recognized that there was a different type of expectation out there for user experience, and that IBM at the time was not able to meet that expectation in the way that we were delivering our offerings. And to her credit, she realized that, designers are the people who have the skills to make that, to make great experiences. That is what we do. And, and so she made in 2012, she made a major investment in building a new program of user experience design at IBM. It's called IBM Design, this division of the company. And she really made, what at the time may have been, viewed as a gamble, a bet that design could really be one of the key drivers of the future of the company. Now looking back on it, it was really a very, solid strategic move.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, as to what would have happened if Ginni hadn't made that bet, if you hadn't have had that top-down leadership decision to invest in customer experience or user experience or whatever term you want to use, whether IBM would have naturally come to that at some point, whether it could have happened from the bottom up. What, do you have an opinion on that? I mean, obviously that's guessing about a future that didn't happen.
I have an absolute opinion about that. And we don't have to guess. Actually, you can look at many, many other companies where that has not been the case, where that top-down leadership, as you call it, which is absolutely right, was not in place. And the traction, the momentum that has been achieved in those companies is way less than what we see at IBM. Absolutely, I think that leadership and vision from the top, really the mandate that she drove down through the company, that design and design thinking were going to be central to the way that we do business and the way that we solve problems at IBM. Without that, with due respect to others who are working in large companies, it just doesn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, sooner or later, you have to get that leadership buy-in and vision for it. And in some ways, it was quite a good position that you had this new person came in that already had that belief and that understanding. So, and so this has inevitably led, as you said, to the establishment of the design group that you've set up. That I believe is based in Austin, Texas. Is that right?
That's right. Yes.
Yeah.
That's where I thought, and that's where I'm based.
Mm-hmm. Ah, right. Okay. Yes. That was, I remember now from watching your presentation. Okay. That's all well and good. So you've created this kind of bridgehead, this point of new culture within the organization. That's a design led culture that exists within Austin. How then do you begin to spread that across a global organization, many divisions, many different factions, for want of a better word, within the organization? I mean, how do you make that culture grow and flourish?
Yeah, that's the key, that's the key question, and it really is a culture change mission that we're on. And we've approached that from with three sort of tactical pillars, if you will. One is that we call them people, places, and practices. Those are the three things that we needed to get right in order for us to really really change the culture of the company. First of all, with people, in 2012, there just quite simply weren't enough designers, formerly trained designers at the company, to make the kind of change that Ginny was envisioning. And so we determined that in order to get to the right balance, the right ratio of designers to, in our case, engineers, software engineers in the company, we needed to hire between 1,000 and 2,000, roughly, designers. Okay. Formerly trained designers into the company. We've now added more than 1,600 designers to the company. So we've gone from basically not quite zero, but close to zero to 1,600 and one of the largest corporate design teams in the world, in 5 years. So we've really scaled up our capacity and our skills for delivering design and great user experiences in the company. So that's the people part, getting more designers. Interestingly about that, we've also, our designers are decentralized. In other words, they're spread out across the company. They're not located organizationally in a centralized bureau or center. Instead, almost all of our designers are reporting into the hierarchy of our various business units. When you think about culture change, that's an important move for us to make, because rather than the designers being isolated and separated, they are stitched into the fabric of the company, working alongside their engineering and product management and other other business partners every day on long-term assignments. So it's not as though, you know, a business out there will say, "Oh, we've got a need for some user experience design now. Let's call up the design center and get a designer for a month or two." No, those designers are working, you know, in those businesses, you know, permanently. So that's an important note for us.
Can I pick up on that just before we lose that train of thought? We need to come back to practices and places, which is the other two that you mentioned. But in regards to that, that does create a problem culturally, at least in my thinking, and I'll be interested to know how you solved it. So, you know, if you put a group of people together in a room, a group of designers together in a room, they reinforce one another, right? They're talking to one another, they're sharing with one another, they're interacting with each other on a daily basis, and that's reinforcing that design-led culture because they're all sitting side by side, right?
Yep.
However, if you take those people and you spread them all over the world, embedded in an existing culture that, let's be honest, isn't primarily design driven, or at least wasn't when I was back there, then suddenly they're isolated and alone. And how do you prevent them getting overwhelmed by the kind of incumbent culture that already exists within the organization?
A couple of ways. It's a great point. There is a risk there in decentralizing design that power that we have by connecting with each other is lost. First of all, no designer is ever alone in our system. So as we are deploying those designers out into the business, I hate the word deploy, but it's sort of apropos in this case. We're doing so in teams. So designers are always being assigned out into these businesses in design team. So it's not as though we're sending one designer out to work on, you know, an IBM cloud business. Instead, we're helping that cloud business build a team, the right team of designers. So that's one way. The second way is actually a segue into the places part of the equation, because our designers, for the most part, are sitting in studio workspaces with other design teams. So we've kind of got a matrix going here where they're reporting organizationally into an IBM business, but they're sitting and co-locating oftentimes with other designers. Here in Austin, we've got about 250 designers working on maybe 15 or 20 different businesses, but sitting in the same space. So we have a very strong design culture here in our Austin studio that really fuels that that intangible thing that I think you were referring to, that we all need as designers to really do our best work.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, I've seen it done the other way around as well, where they sit with their business units on a kind of day-to-day basis, but they're reporting into a centralized design team, which is the kind of reverse of what you've talked about. But the same, because their reporting lines are into design, and because their, you know, their performance reviews and their training sessions and all of the other things they do are part of the design team's kind of strategy, then they maintain that culture, even though they're embedded on a daily basis within individual business units, etc.
Right.
Because it's a tricky problem, isn't it, to overcome? Which brings us on, I guess, to practices, which was the other element that you were talking about, which is, you know, how you assess people and how you work together and that kind of stuff. So tell us a little bit about that, what you do there.
I'll just close out the places note with we do have Austin is our home base studio, if you will, our largest studio. We now have 44 design studios around the world. So that's how we can get that, you know, we can actually make that co-location happen. you know, because we can have, we've got these design teams that are spread around the world, and we need the network of workspaces to support that. So that's just sort of the closing note on the places item. For practices, really, we needed a common way for not only our designers, but for their teammates, their non-design teammates, to work together with a focus on the user, with a focus on user experience and human experience. And we've got many sort of practice areas that we've been developing, but it all sort of works around our practice of design thinking, and we have a sort of retooled the commonly used approach of design thinking to be really appropriate for the scale and the speed of a global enterprise. You think about design thinking, it's usually applied in a fairly discrete setting, you know, a smaller studio, an agency, you know, a startup, where you might have, as Jeff Bezos would say, you might have, you know, two pizzas worth of people who need to, you know, collaborate around it. Well, we have teams with hundreds of people, maybe even thousands of people, who need to be aligning around a common mission. And so we've really had to retool design thinking to work at that level with some tactical elements that we've added to it. It's become very important for us to get as many non-designers at IBM to understand at least the basic principles of design thinking as possible. And, you know, when you think about, you know, company of 360,000 people, 1600 of them are designers. The rest of that population are coming from a wide range of other disciplines. And many of them are, you know, as you described earlier, are kind of, you know, used to working in a very, let's say generously, a very traditional way of solving problems. So it's been important for us to make sure that we get design thinking out to as many of those people as possible. We now have an online learning platform, which has given access to design thinking to the entire company. And we now, at latest check, we have about a third of the company, about 120,000 people, have gone through the online design thinking learning experience that we've built. And by no means are those 120,000 people all going to be, you know, master design thinkers in a several hour online experience. That's not the case at all. But we do know that they come out of that experience with a real familiarity with the basic ideas and concepts and language of design thinking, and some of the behavior of it. And we're really finding that we're hitting that tipping point now where we can assume that a designer or a design team at IBM out in one of those business units that I described, you know, earlier, that they are going to be working in an environment where many, maybe even most of the people that they're working with are pretty familiar with and have an appreciation for design thinking. And we're finding that really reduces the friction that team, that design team faces. And they're able to move faster. They're able to get their teams aligned. They're able to have more effective collaboration across disciplines. And it's really having some positive value to the company.
I guess the one challenge relating to that is that there's a difference, isn't there, between understanding a concept and appreciating the value of it. So, you know, you can explain design thinking and some of the basic mechanisms and techniques around that relatively easily. But that doesn't necessarily mean that people are bought into the idea. right? You know, are enthusiastic that they believe in its potential. So what has been the primary tool for winning hearts and minds? Is it the online learning environment? Does that switch people on? Or is it more the kind of actually doing it in practice, collaborating with a designer on a project kind of thing? Or is it something else entirely?
The online learning experience is only an entry point. You're absolutely right. It's not a substitute for, it's just a way to kind of, I don't know, pick your metaphor.
Get
just
the vocabulary.
Add a little, you know, oil to the machine, you know, just so that, just to kind of get the conditions, you know, better suited for when those designers then actually come in and begin working in this deeply collaborative way. The people that they're working with are just a little bit more receptive to it, but we're finding that that little bit of receptivity is super important, and it's way different than 5 years ago when, you know, we would say the words design thinking or user experience, you know, and just the blank stare that we would get from other people in the company. Now they're nodding their head, they're leaning in, they're eager to work with us. It's a very different tone around the company now.
Yeah. And I mean, that can be half the battle sometimes, is that, you know, you talk about something like user experience or design thinking or whatever else it is, and if it's not something people are familiar with, our initial reaction to anything new and unusual is a degree of apprehension and fear. So I suppose by having something like that learning environment, you're at least beginning to address, you know, and give people enough knowledge that they're not afraid of it in the same way. Is that your experience?
Yeah. And I would twist that a little bit. I think you said it very well. There is an element of fear and sort of suspicion, you know, about a new, about anything new. That's a very natural sort of human reaction. But what we're finding, interestingly, is that when we can build trust across the disciplines and across the lines in a multidisciplinary team, that is the key. When we have a team of designers, engineers, and product managers who know each other and trust each other on a human level, that is the transformational moment. That team, in all likelihood, is going to be a high functioning team. When we lack that, and we often lack that with a new team that's just been formed and they don't know each other yet, and they don't quite, you know, understand each other, they haven't gotten into that real rhythm with each other, that's where our teams struggle. And we find that design thinking allows them to build that trust faster and more effectively than they could before, where they didn't have that language of collaboration that's really at the core of that practice.
I mean, that raises another interesting element to this, that you've undertaken an enormous recruitment process of where you've been hiring a lot of designers. And I know probably partly because of the sheer number of people that you're trying to recruit, you've taken on a lot of new graduates and people just starting, you know, out in their design career. And in my experience, one of the things that you lack the most when starting out your career is that collaborative knowledge of how to work well with other people. But that's kind of just the tip of an iceberg of things you don't know when you're starting out. How do you onboard that number of designers, you know, and get them to a point where they're actually working in the IBM way and, you know, working alongside other people well?
We've absolutely seen the need for effective onboarding of new designers. And to your point, we've of those 1,600 designers that we've added, more than half of them have been directly from university directly out of academic programs or within the first sort of year or two of graduation. And so they're at the beginning of their career. They haven't been out there to develop the thick skin and the resiliency and the and some of the soft skills that are needed to really function in a complex environment. What we've done, and back to my earlier roles and around education within the company, we instituted back in 2013, as we were bringing our first group of newly hired designers into the company, we instituted a boot camp style onboarding program, a 3-month experience that is the first 3 months of that new designer's experience at IBM. And we've now run that. We've run that program twice a year in the winter and in the summer, with anywhere from 30 to 80 designers at a time. We've now run it. We're going to run our 12th edition of that this coming summer, and the collaboration is really the key element of that experience. Mm. We definitely find that, you know, even the most gifted and skilled designers from a tangible skill point of view, even the most gifted frequently lack the ability to work in a complex collaborative team. That's the skill that we are, and it is a skill that we are focused on in that bootcamp experience. It's really important for us, and these those 3 months are very, very project based. They're very team oriented. That is the way that designers are working in the modern, you know, business environment. Those complex teams where they're collaborating not just with other designers, but with other experts in different fields. Here at IBM, we've got, you know, certain types of technical skills that we have to collaborate with. But you think about all the other environments that a designer can, you know, will find themselves in out in the world. You know, in the healthcare industry, it's you know, subject matter experts and practitioners in medical areas, you know, in financial services, it might be, you know, economists and you know, other financial leaders. So that is a necessity, I think, for designers in the world now, to be able to work in these complex teams, to be able to understand them and frequently these teams are changing very fast. You know, a project will change or a new project will get launched and boom, all of a sudden you're in a new team and you need to quickly understand the dynamics of that team and get working as soon as possible.
I mean, that, just thinking about that training program, you know, a 3-month training program, there must have been so many challenges involved in just putting that together, let alone, you know, winning hearts and minds across the organization, setting up working practices, getting management, you know, getting middle management buy-in, which I often find is harder than getting management buy-in at the very top. You know, there's so many complexities here. I mean, what's been the real standout pain in the ass for you? What's been the biggest challenge that you faced?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the middle, we call it the frozen middle here at IBM. It's been incredibly important, as I said, to have the leadership from the C level of the company for our mission. But there are a lot of people in a company of this size that are, you know, in those middle management, project or product management, you know, areas where they're being measured on, you know, they're under a lot of pressure. I always try to have empathy for them because there's a lot of pressure at that level of a company to, and you're not being measured by and large, you know, on how well your team collaborates or on how well your team adopts design thinking or some other practice.
Mm.
You're being measured on, you know, a whole other set of metrics. And so, you know, that it takes a lot of courage for that that middle manager, that mid-level leader in a company like this to really say, yes, this is going to be hard, but we are going to do this. We are going to change. And I know it's going to be, you know, I might have a couple of rough quarters, you know, in my reviews, but I'm going to ride through that because I believe so strongly in this. And you know, we've definitely found, you know, those people who have that fortitude. And, you know, you need to find them and you need to wrap your arms around them and just work very closely with them. And then they start to proliferate. Then you start to see some of the other, mm-hmm. you know, the other snowmen or snow women or, you know, start to thaw out a little bit and begin to see the light.
I love the fact that you talk about empathizing with these people, because I think it's ironic, isn't it, really, that as designers, our job is to understand people, understand how they think, you know, and we're really good at doing that with end users. But I think we can often be terrible at doing that with our own stakeholders and the people that we're working alongside. And I totally agree with what you're saying about middle management. That it's a massively difficult position to be in. And they've got all their metrics that they're trying to meet. And it's really hard to ask them to step out of their comfort zone and try something new. Which brings me actually nicely onto the very last question that I wanted to ask you, which is about proving the benefit of this massive investment in design. You know, as you're talking to these people across the organization and you're saying to them, look, if you work differently, you know, there will be these benefits. You know, you will see, improvements actually in the metrics you're being measured on in the longer term. How mm-hmm. do you go about doing that? I mean, what business benefits have you seen and been able to talk about, you know, to the rest of the organization to prove that this big investment's been worthwhile?
Yeah. That's not only the big question in our transformation at IBM, but I, you know, as long as I've been in the design industry, that's been sort of the holy grail that we've been chasing for is some real quantifiable data that proves the value of what we're doing. Interestingly, we've worked with Forrester Research in the last year. They've conducted a really deep analysis of our program here at IBM, and specifically around how the value that our practice of design and design thinking is bringing to our clients. And this has been released, and you can find it easily. I'll send you a link to it, Paul, and you can post it.
Oh, thanks.
It's a fascinating study, and they've really been able to determine several important things that we've always suspected, but we've never really been able to say clearly. First of all, that teams that have the right balance of designers on staff and are practicing this collaborative approach of design thinking, that they are moving faster, that they are getting from idea to market faster than ever before. And in fact, Forrester is saying that the IBM teams and client teams that we're working with are moving twice as fast as they previously were, which is a phenomenal thing for us to be able to say at this point. And it's wild. It's like, wow, we've seen it. We've kind of seen it anecdotally. But now to be able to say, yes, it's true, twice as fast to market. And we've got all sorts of great great examples now through this report from Forrester. In turn, then, they've been able to measure the return on investment with these teams and with these clients. And what they found is that there is a more than 300% return on investment for for the investment in design thinking in this new approach. So 300%, and we've got just some phenomenal client quotes that are included in this Forrester report saying that, you know, we paid for our entire investment, you know, a 2-year investment with IBM in 2 months because we were working in this new way, because we were able to align that much faster, because our teams were moving that much faster to release and to market. You know, so there's just some great data that's coming out of this. We're really excited about it. Yeah. Yeah. And of course we're employing some other, ways of measuring, such as, you know, NPS and some other more tactical, things that are certainly in place, but it's really great to see an outside source come in and, mm-hmm. and really take a clean look at our program and come to these great conclusions.
I think there will be a lot of designers that are very keen to get their hands on that Forrester analysis. Look, if IBM yeah. can do it, so could we, kind of attitude. Yeah. So that's brilliant. Yeah. Talking yeah. of which, yeah. is there, where can people find out more about what you guys are doing? And I know that you're sharing a lot of it online, which is wonderful. So where yeah. can people find that stuff out?
Yeah. IBM.com/design is our home base online. We publish all of our practices, and we've got some great resources there for designers. It's all, as you said, we're very open with our program and our practices, and we love to share it with the industry. We learn a lot from these types of conversations, and we feel that, you know, if we can help you know, the tide rise a little bit, then that benefits mm-hmm. all of us.
Yeah, absolutely. Doug, thank you so much for your time. I could carry on talking for forever, but unfortunately we need to wrap it up now. And yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul. I've enjoyed the discussion.
So what did you think of that one, Marcus?
Amazing, really. A couple of things came to mind. One is that nothing was happening, really, until new CEO arrived. And then it was,
yeah.
you need to have, I mean, we say it over and over again, but you need to have this kind of top-down, you know, buy-in. But it was basically down to that one person saying, this is how it's going to be. And
yeah.
and then it happened, and it's just like, wow, 1,600 designers. We're just going to hire 1,600 designers, just like that. Amazing.
Yeah. Well, not quite just like that, Marcus. You made that sound very easy then.
No, well, that was my point. It's like, how on earth do you even start to do
know.
That? Trying to find one is hard.
Well, they've basically got them straight out of university yeah, and yeah. are putting them through that academy.
Yeah.
You see, they need the academy domain name,
they do.
Just like I have.
But that was... sorry, carry on.
Yeah, that was a very interesting one. I've got to say, I kind of... The same thing went through my head. And recently, I'm beginning to... I've always encouraged people to do grassroots change, you know, to try and encourage change. And, you know... You can certainly make a difference. You can certainly build enough momentum to get the attention of senior management. But you, at the end of the day, you do need senior management. It's impossible otherwise.
Yeah, I'm meeting up with a client that we did some strategy work for 3 years ago, which was, you know, that was sponsored by somebody on the board at the time. And then that person left right at the point yeah. when we delivered the report. And yeah. it's just floated, and I'm meeting them again tomorrow, and I think my major thrust is going to be you need to get somebody on the board back on this, because nothing's yeah. happened in between. So,
yeah. yeah.
But
yeah.
the other point that he made that I thought, oh, that's I hadn't really thought of it like that, is this idea, with you mentioned the boot camps they do, and that he said that the focus is on teaching people to work together, mm-hmm. you know, because it's a necessity in the world. And it's kind of like... What occurred to me is if you're giving people all this power, so like, you know, we're going to be design-led, then you've got to teach them how to wield that power. I'd never thought of
yeah.
that before.
With great power comes great responsibility, Marcus.
Exactly, and I would imagine that most design students coming out of university aren't thinking that way. They're thinking, I want to be a designer.
Yeah. And also, I might be painting all junior designers with my own brush of my own experience. Yeah. But, you know, truth be told, I was an arrogant little shit back then. You know, and Marcus, I know you still consider me to be an arrogant little shit.
Itching to say things here. No, but you were, as was I. Well, maybe not when, early 20s, I was a bit better, but when I was a teenager, I was hideous. So,
yeah. And you've got to, it is one of the most valuable skills, isn't it? It's certainly in UX design. Mm. You know, within interface design, you can kind of sit in a corner and, you know, grumble at everybody, but nobody's listening to you and be artistic. This is huge, sweeping general. I'm going to get so much trouble for this. But as soon as you start moving into user experience design, which is, you know, absolutely essential that you're closely collaborating with people throughout the process. If you're a dick, people aren't going to want to help you. And if people don't want to help you, you're not going to get anything done. No. It's as simple as that, isn't it?
Yeah, you end up losing your job.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, but don't be a dick, kids.
That really chimed with me.
Mm, absolutely. Okay, let's talk about our second sponsor, which is Full Story. Full Story, I like to describe... Obviously, they wouldn't describe themselves in this way, but I like to describe Full Story as simply the best session recorder out there. I have to say at this point, I've not tried every session recorder out there, so there might possibly be one that's better. But I'm pretty confident that they've got to be pretty close to the top of the list. So we all know that session recorders will allow you to watch back user sessions, to see how they move around the site, what they do, those kinds of things. Incredibly useful for getting insights into the way users are naturally behaving on the site. You know, if you put a user in a usability lab, they're going to immediately behave differently. Well, they're not if they're just going about their business on a website. But some session recorders can actually be really frustrating. You can be overwhelmed with the sheer number of sessions that you get back, and it can be hard to find what you want to see and to understand that. And you can often, you also have to plan ahead about the kind of data you want to gather and the particular behaviors you're monitoring. And Full Story resolves both of these issues. So it records everything about all the sessions, meaning you don't have to plan ahead. You can simply search on almost anything that you want to know about, from, you know, what people have clicked on to what DOM elements they've interacted with to, you know, whether they've rage click. It's all there. And because you can search on it, not only does that mean you don't have to plan ahead, it also means you can narrow it down to the specific things you want to know. Like, I want to see every session of a person that has clicked on this button or not clicked on this button or clicked on this button and then done this. You know, you can get that kind of granular detail. You can sign up today. You get a free month of their pro account, absolutely free of charge. There's no entering a credit card or anything like that. If you get to the end of the month and you decide you can't justify the fee, but you really like it and want to carry on using it, then you can carry on using it for as long as you want, free of charge, and it'll record 1,000 sessions per month. If you want more than 1,000 sessions, then, well, you probably work for a larger organization and you can afford the fee and stop being so tight. You can find out more and get started by going to fullstory.com/BOAG. Please make sure you include the BOAG so that I get the credit. It's all about me. Okay, Marcus, what joke do you have for us?
This is Bob Salmon's very, very English joke that I will have to explain, but I love it. Bob Salmon.
Is it about the royal wedding?
No, it's not, actually.
Oh, good. Because that's the only thing that any British person seems to be able to talk about at the moment.
Really? I'm not interested in it at all. But we had, where I live, there was, they put a huge screen up down on the Oak Common, where they had the royal wedding, and then they had a film on for the kids, and then they did the FA Cup final, and then another film for the adults in the evening.
Oh, that's
it was
nice.
Very good. So that was kind of cool, but you know, I'm not really interested in all that malarkey. But no, this is about, well, I'll just say the joke. Bob from the Slack channel. Both Cream and the Jam were due to reunite for a tour of Devon and Cornwall, but the venues couldn't agree about who should go on first.
Yeah, that is a very British joke. Don't explain it.
Okay.
Just leave it hanging. If you know, let's exclude the rest of the world in a kind of xenophobic and arrogant way, I say.
All right.
All right, that's that done then. So if you two want to submit jokes that no one else in the rest of the world will get, feel free to join the Slack channel by going to boagworld.com/slacking. If you are a non-British resident and you know why that was a funny joke, feel free to submit that to the Slack channel and prove us Brits as being ignorant. Next week, what have we got next week? Oh yeah, we've got Molly Stevens from Uber next week. So we've done a few now of very traditional kind of companies like Cisco and IBM and universities and stuff like that. Next week we have our first kind of digital startup. At what point does Uber stop being a startup? Now they're in like 66 countries. I don't think you can call them a startup anymore, can you really?
No, they're not. They're a proper big, you know, kind of a grown-up
company. Yes. A post-digital company.
Yes, but they started in the digital era.
I don't know.
That's the difference.
Come up with a Silicon Valley company. Yeah. There we go. All right, so join us for the interview with Molly next week. And, of course, Marcus's thought for the day and joke, which is what the show is really all about. But until then, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.
Bye.